This morning, Brian asked if I would look at the genealogy of Jesus in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 to 38. First time in my entire born days I've ever been asked to give a message on a genealogy, and I thought, this is excellent. I would just love to do this, because I have found these genealogies interesting. And so last night we were joking around in the kitchen, the Whitleys and ourselves, so maybe I should read through the genealogy, and then maybe they'll do read through Matthew's, and then of course you can't do that without reading through some of the Old Testament genealogies, and then by the time we finish reading through all the genealogies, I'll only have about 2 minutes left, and I'll just say, are there any thoughts about and applications? But no, it's not going to be as you fear. I hope it's not as you fear. So just by way of preview, I want to divide this talk into three sections. I want to, first of all, look at an overview and an introduction to the two genealogies of Jesus, because you can't really talk about Luke's genealogy without bringing up Matthew's genealogy as well, the one in Matthew. And then in the second section, which will be the main chunk of my talk, will be what the Old Testament tells us about Christ's genealogies. And then, of course, you can't have a good genealogical discussion with having some take-home points, some practical applications. So we will look at what in the world can we take home from what we're seeing here this morning. So let's begin with the introduction and overview of the two genealogies. Let's make a couple of observations here, and I've summarized both Matthew's and Luke's genealogy here. Summarize as in, don't put all the names in here, but Matthew's would be here on the left, and Luke's is on the right. Now, Matthew's genealogy, as you will notice on the summary over here on the right, that comes through King Solomon, the line of the kings, actually. All the kings of Judah are mentioned, well, not all of them, actually. We'll have a brief observation there. But the kings of Judah are formed that line, and it ends with Joseph. And then the next thing to point out is that the other genealogy comes through a totally different son, Nathan. So four kings are blotted out from the line of the kings of Judah, and this appears to be intentional. And it's intentional because it says there that there were 14 generations from David to the deportation to Babylon. And if you actually work your way through the Old Testament, you'll find out that, well, no, there's not 14. There's four kings missing in this genealogy, but there's the recurrence of the 14 seems to indicate that this is an intentional leaving out of four kings. And the last king of the line of kings of Judah is known in the Old Testament by three different names, King Jeconiah, King Jehoiachin, or short for Jeconiah is just Coniah. And then you have the four missing kings, Ahaziah, Jehoash, and Amaziah, and Jehoiakim. I'm not going to say much about them. I have a little appendix here if we have time, but I did a timing this morning, and I'm not sure we'll get to that. But I think there's some interesting things about them that to note about the four missing kings that maybe somebody can look at it at a different date, or they may have already been looked at by Joel. I don't know. I think Joel did a genealogical discussion here some time ago. I don't know if that was covered. And then we make an interesting observation. So the last king of Judah was King Jeconiah, or Coniah. And then immediately afterwards, you have Shealtiel. And Shealtiel is also listed as as from Neri, who's of the line of Nathan. So what's going on here? We see a convergence there, and then Shealtiel has Zerubbabel and Abihud, and then he has at least two sons. One is Abihud, and the other is Risa. And then Abihud is the line that's given of the royal line, let's say, so to speak, and it ends in Joseph and then Jesus, who is the adopted son of Joseph. And then on the right, we see that Zerubbabel, the other son, Risa, had more sons, and I've left them all out of here, except for the last one, Heli, or Eli. And Jesus Christ is of Eli as well there. So what is going on here? Both genealogies, we can infer this from Jewish history, both genealogies would have been readily available prior to the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And why do we say that? It's because We make some observations that the Talmud, first of all, and the Talmud was only, the Babylonian Talmud was assembled after the time of Christ, but it was assembled from documents and teachings that were slightly before the time of Christ, during the first century, and slightly afterwards. But what we read in the Talmud is that a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew was not even a legal marriage. That was a really looked down upon. That was not something you wanted. If you are a pious God, and I use pious in a good sense, so you know, we can always use pious in a bad sense by about hypocrites, but a genuinely sincere follower of God in the first century who was a Jew would have wanted to stay reputable. And so in order for Mary and Joseph's marriage to be legal, they would have to be able to prove they were descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, it's not surprising that those genealogies exist because we read about them earlier on in Ezra when they were determining, in Ezra and Nehemiah, when they came back from Babylon some 400 years earlier from the time of Christ. There were certain mixed marriages, and there were people who wanted to serve in the temple, but they weren't sure they could show their genealogy from Levi and so forth. So we already observe that these genealogies were being recorded and kept 400 years earlier at the time when the exiles from Babylon started returning back to Israel. We see there that some were proving they were Jews descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and others were not. These records would have likely been stored in the temple complex or in Jerusalem, but probably in the temple complex, where children were dedicated to the Lord at circumcision or after when they were purified. So, and there's a little picture of a part of the Babylonian Talmud. So since Joseph and Mary brought Jesus to the temple to be dedicated, we can infer from that they were observant Jews, that they were religious Jews, and they wanted everything to be done properly and correctly and uprightly. And they wanted their marriage to be, not only would their marriage be legal, but this, they couldn't probably have done this if they were regarded as a non-existent marriage. Then what are they doing bringing their child to the temple to be dedicated? So there's an inference here that Mary and Joseph were legally married. Now, marriage at that time, there was that betrothal period where Joseph did not have consummate marriage until after Christ was born. But in the Old Testament, we see that betrothal or engagement period was held very, it's essentially you were considered to be married to that person even if you had not had the final step of that marriage take place, such that if there was sexual immorality involved between one of the engaged people, that was considered to be adultery, and that was had a different approach. So all this to say is that nobody would be making up genealogies here. Luke was a very careful historian, and he had done a lot of work. He records at the beginning. He says, actually, many people, he refers to many people, had actually made accounts or written accounts or produced accounts of the life of Christ. And the Holy Spirit, as he is putting together the New Testament for us, draws from four of those accounts, but we can infer from that there were probably other accounts that were not necessarily divinely inspired, or maybe they were accurate, but they just weren't necessary for the New Testament. But neither would Matthew. Matthew's account, Matthew's gospel, appears to be written for the Jew. And that's one of the reasons he starts off with the genealogy of Jesus. So Matthew himself would not, it would be just absurd for Matthew to make up a genealogy to try and, because anybody could go to the temple and just see themselves who's what the genealogy was. And in the same way, it would be absurd to make for Luke to make up a genealogy as well when he would have known that prior to 70 AD. That does raise other questions as to when Luke wrote his gospel. And I think there's internal evidence there that Acts was written prior to before 62 AD, which we don't really have time. I'm sure Brian has probably covered this or somebody else, why the internal evidence is there that Acts would have had to been written prior to James's death as leader of the Church of Jerusalem, prior to Paul's death in 64 AD at the hands of Nero, and prior to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So if Luke wrote Acts, then, and Luke wrote Luke before the book of Acts, then Luke gets, you know, into the late 50s probably. Certainly before the time, during the time when all the genealogies would have been available. No, hopefully you're finding that the adrenaline rush you're getting from this is keeping you awake. I just find it interesting. But there's some other observations I made. For the first time, actually, as I was studying here, I observed that Luke covers more about Mary than any other of the four Gospels, and quite a bit more about Mary, including internal personal thoughts. So, for example, in the first chapter, there's 31 verses where Mary is either the primary character or one of the primary characters in the case of her visit to, and that's from verses 26 through 56, 31 verses there. And by the way, for those of you wondering, 56 minus 26 is not 31, but you remember it's inclusive, so it's 56 minus 25. That's where you get your 31. And the other thing that's interesting is that Mary is mentioned a total of 12 times in the first two chapters leading up to the genealogy in chapter 3. And that's not counting all the personal pronouns used for Mary either. That goes up a lot more than that. Whereas Joseph is only mentioned a total of 3 times in the first two chapters. So it appears that certain information given in Luke, given in these first two chapters and given in Luke is actually from Mary's perspective. We're finding out things that only Mary would have known at the time Luke wrote this, because Joseph had already died or passed on. We can infer that from other passages in the Gospels. So Mary would have survived, and we know that she was still alive at the time of the crucifixion of Christ because she was there. So Luke, the best explanation, it's not the only explanation, but probably the most straightforward explanation, is that Luke indicates he very carefully researched and compiled about the life of Christ, and the best explanation is that he may have personally obtained this information from Mary herself, given that there's things stated there such in the first chapter, chapter 2, it says, but Mary treasured all these things, pondering them in her heart. So she was keeping track of all of these things, thinking about them, and it's not something she was discussing with necessarily with Joseph. Maybe she wanted to, as often the case, and maybe Joseph was, you know, how it is sometimes, just not seeing things from as being as powerful as Mary might have seen them. And then again, another quote from chapter 2 and verse 51, it says, and his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Now, how would Luke find out about that? The best explanation is he's getting it from Mary, but there's something bigger going on here, is that Luke makes it crystal clear in chapter 1 that Christ would be called the Son of God. Because in that, when the angel appears to Mary, Mary says, how can this be? Like, I'm a virgin. And it's that point that the angel informs her how this can be, that she would conceive and give birth, and that she would have no, this child would have no human father. And the angel says, for this reason, he will be called the Son of God. So if you're wondering why Jesus was called the Son of God, that reason is given in Luke chapters 1 and 2 when the angel appears to Mary, because he will have no human father. So this establishes that Christ, when the angel appears to Mary, it's established that Christ would not be a physical descendant of David through Joseph. Yet we have Joseph's genealogy in Matthew, which would be necessary if Christ is going to be heir to the throne of Israel, because that's the throne line there. But Luke has already just established in chapter 1 and 2 that Joseph is not, he is not, first of all, Jesus is not a physical descendant of Joseph, and so that whole lineage is gone. He's not a descendant of David from that angle. It would be essential, therefore, because the ancient prophecy said he would be a physical descendant of David. The Messiah would be a physical descendant of David. And there's other ancient prophecy we'll look at shortly, but it would be necessary, therefore, to establish that Mary would be, because Jesus was physically born of Mary, that Mary is a physical descendant of David. That would be essential. So it's within this context of chapters 1 and 2, which deals primarily with Mary, and Mary is the main character, it's within this context that chapter 3 then presents the genealogy that we see there today, given in chapter 3. So Joseph's genealogy in Matthew, necessary to establish Christ's rightful heir to the throne of Israel. And in that society, if you were an adopted son, which Jesus would be adopted by Joseph, you had all the full rights and privileges of a normal son. And he's the adopted firstborn son. He would be the oldest son in that family, and therefore he would be heir to the throne of Israel, even though he's only adopted by Joseph. But at the same time, we need to establish Christ's physical descendancy from David. So Luke presents the physical, that's kind of like a general consensus amongst conservative or evangelical scholars as to what this Luke genealogy is about. But there's something else about the way that genealogy begins I just wanted to point out. It says, when he began his ministry, Jesus himself was about 30 years of age. And I'm doing it, this section right here, the next two lines, literal translation, because you will see the son of. But actually the son, the word son, only appears once in that entire genealogy. And that's in that parenthetical statement that you see right there, being a supposed son of Joseph. The word son in the Greek is literally there, but the word son never appears from that point on in the genealogy. But we do have a statement that's clearly parenthetical, given what we've just learned in chapters 1 and 2, that Jesus is not actually the son of Joseph. He's actually the son of God. So we have Jesus beginning his ministry of about 30 years of age, and then this parenthetical statement being supposed the son of Joseph, and then the genealogy continues from here to there. So Jesus is actually of Eli, of Matthew, but of course there's Mary in the middle, but back then when you're giving an official genealogy, the mother would not normally be mentioned unless in context with her relationship with her husband. So in the Matthew genealogy, you have two women being mentioned, but the husband is mentioned, and then Rahab the harlot and Ruth the Moabitess are mentioned in that genealogy, but within the relationship with the husband. But this is awkward because the husband here is not literally, physically, the son, the father of Jesus, but it needs to be established that he's a physical descendant of David. So therefore, this jumps, you got the parenthetical statement, and then you have Jesus, 30 years of Eli, of Matthew, and on so forth, descendant of David. And so we have here a descendancy of, so, question, is there further support for this from the Old Testament to back up, and what can we learn from all of this? So thus far, this is just very interesting, but I think it's going to become more interesting very shortly. So now let's look at section 2 of my talk here, and that's what the Old Testament tells us about Christ's genealogies. The earliest messianic prophecy given in time is found in Genesis chapter 3 after the fall. And God says to Eve, he says, I'll put enmity between you and the, he says actually to the serpent. He says, the devil. And he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. Same word used in both cases here. But this is generally regarded as a very interesting statement. The word seed is singular here. It's not between your descendants throughout history. They'll be having a tough time with Satan. No. It's between there will be your seed, and there will be enmity between this. And that's regarded by some exegetes as a direct reference to the Messiah. There will be a particular descendant of the woman who will crush or bruise the head of Satan. But the man is left out here. He doesn't say that to Adam. And it's a foreshadowing later on of this messianic prophecy that a virgin will conceive and give birth to a son. So that suggests that the defeater of Satan someday, the one who will crush the head of Satan, will be a physical descendant of a woman, and it does raise questions about what's the man involvement here, and basically, as we find out, Jesus was born of a virgin birth. So we should expect, for even this reason right here, that we would need some time in the future to establish that Mary, who's the only physical ancestor of Jesus, I mean the immediate one through whom Jesus was born physically, we need to know what Mary's genealogy will be, because we need to have this prophecy fulfilled. Let's look at a few more prophecies here that I think speak to these genealogies. God says, I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. Now, the interesting thing here is that this prophecy was made roughly circa 950 years before the time of Christ. But it states that the Messiah would be both a physical descendant of David, because the word seed is used here, be a physical descendant of David, and of course, if he's going to be on the throne of Israel, he's also will be a heir to the throne of Israel, and there's only one person in each generation who is the heir to the throne of Israel. Sorry, heir to a throne of Israel, but even heir, to, let's say, to the British throne. So right now, that's Queen Elizabeth. She's the rightful heir to the throne. But the moment she passes on, then Charles becomes the new heir to the new rightful person to sit on the throne. And the moment he passes on, and you can just go forward, we actually got quite a backup here, because Queen Elizabeth is doing a very good job of living a long time. So there's actually a few generations now waiting for their turn at the throne. Then there's another prophecy. The one who would rule the world is actually a descendant of David, the son of Jesse. It says, then a shoot will arise from the spring of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon this person. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth, not just Israel or Judah, but for the afflicted of the world. And he will strike the earth, not just Judah, but the whole earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. And now when you look at what it says about this individual who comes from a descendant of David, you see that this person, this is a messianic prophecy. This is the one whom the Jews are waiting for, who will not only be their king, but the ruler of the whole world, the one who will restore righteousness to the world. But again, you see here there's a prophecy that the Messiah would be a descendant of King David. So if you're going through the line of Solomon, you see there's going to be a problem at the end, because the very last person before Jesus is Joseph and is not literally of the seed of Joseph. So there's a problem there, which will be resolved, of course, as you might suspect. Next prophecy. It says here, again in Isaiah, about 700 years before the time of Christ, it says, a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called, now look at these names here, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. So the interesting thing about here again is that, first of all, this word child is just the Hebrew word yelad, and yelad is just your normal word for little boy. It even is that to this day. Yelad is just little boy in Hebrew. The word born is yulad, which means to be physically born. So we're talking about someone who will be physically born someday, but then you look at the names, and names like Mighty God, Eternal Father, you see, this is no normal little boy here. But if this child were to be the Son of God through an immaculate conception, as had been prophesied, then you can see how this prophecy will be fulfilled. But this person is rightful heir to the throne of David. So it has to come through that line of kings. At the same time, we just know there's a little problem at the end. Okay, takeaway. All this establishes that the Messiah would have to be both a descendant of David and rightful heir to the throne of Israel. Those are the two criteria that have to be satisfied. But we see there's a problem we're running into with the last of the kings of Judah, and it states this. As I live, declares the Lord, even though Kaniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off, and I will give you over into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. But this is the line of the kings. And we know from another passage that it appears that Kaniah actually had some sons. So how is this prophecy going to be fulfilled? But it doesn't look good for the Messiah to come through the line of the kings. Not at all. And here is what happened. We are told what happens to Jeconiah, Jehoiachin, or Kaniah. Remember, those are the three names for the same person. And in the Babylonian script, it's slightly different as well. It says in Jeremiah, it says, "Now it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the 12th month of the 21st of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign," note the detail here, "showed favor to Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison." Let's just pause there. Brought him out of prison, what do you mean? He had been captured by the Babylonians and put into prison. He'd sat there for 37 years. 37 years he'd sat in jail. A lot of time to think about the wickedness of your evil ways. A lot of time to just molder away and give up all hope and all despair. But for whatever reason, this king who came after Nebuchadnezzar released King Jeconiah or Kaniah from jail. And then it says that a regular allowance was given him by the king of Babylon, a daily portion of all the days of his life until the day of his death. So it says he was released from jail and he was given a ration or a portion of food and whatever he needed to live on from that point on. And since Brian is already a member of the organization that published this photo, he's probably already told you about this. But anyways, I thought I'd say it again. This is actually a part of a tablet found in an archaeological dig near the Ishtar Gate in Babylon. And on it, it's actually a list of all the people who are receiving the king's ration. And believe it or not, it mentions Jehoiachin, king of the land of Judah, on the food ration list. And isn't it remarkable that you have now they have his name pronounced different, I should tell you, in Babylonian script, but it's nobody disputes this is King Jehoiachin of the in the archaeological world, as far as I'm aware. But actually, when you see this little bit down here, and people today say that, that was written around, almost 600 years before, or maybe 500 and some years before the time of Christ. How much were they making up by then, and how are the details and things go? Well, so nobody would assume. When you see this actually confirmed, this little tiny detail, there's one thing you can, I'm a little off track here, but I teach a senior youth in our church, and last Sunday, I was there, and I was showing them the archaeological evidence for the Old Testament, and there's a lot of these little details, just little details said in passing, that archaeology has now said, that actually happened. In some cases, they actually give us more information than even the Bible has, detailed information. And so what you can take home from this little thing right here, is that if the Old Testament got it right in the tiny little details that don't seem to have to do with anything really important, if those details can be confirmed, then we have much more confidence in all the big events that are spoken there as well. If you get off on the archaeological stuff, which I'm sure Brian will keep you posted on a regular basis. So how is this fulfilled? How is it fulfilled that that Jehoiachin, even though it looks like he had some sons, nobody would prosper on the throne of Israel? Well, here it is. Isaiah. Oh, this is the beginning of how it's fulfilled. "Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, 'Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left.'" Now, this is a few generations before Jehoiachin. "Nothing shall be left, says the Lord, and some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." So the word son is used not just to refer to your immediate son, but in Hebrew and in the Old Testament, it was referred to grandsons, great-grandsons. In fact, all your male descendants were referred to as sons, to the extent you even get the entire sons of Israel or sons of Jacob being referred as Jacob's sons, all the males who have descended from him. So he's saying that someday, people who will come from you, who will descend from you, these sons, they will be eunuchs in the palace in Babylon. And eunuchs, for those of you who may not be familiar with the term, there's the Hebrew word used as saris. Denominative means to castrate. They've been relieved of their ability to reproduce. That's what a eunuch is. a term given to officials in Babylon who were eunuchs. So this, there was a certain type of official, and if you had that type, you knew that actually you were a eunuch. Now, to continue on, in Daniel, we read, the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. And this is the first deportation to Babylon. This would be Jeconiah and whatever his sons, and not just the sons, but the relatives, any noble men. So that's what of the royal family and of the nobility. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Now, okay, so if you're reporting to somebody, he's recalled the chief of the eunuchs, and he is chief of all the people reporting to him, and you're one of those people, and he's referred to as chief of the eunuchs, you can infer from that that all of these noblemen, all these sons, every one of them had been converted into eunuchs. They had been given the operation. And this was actually quite common in ancient times. If you had people serving the king in the palace, they were thought to be of no leadership ability, that they would not be a threat to reestablish the kingdom if they were eunuchs, because part of the thing is you need to be able to producing heirs, and none of these guys could produce heirs anymore because they had been castrated. Now, we can infer from that, I mean, that seems to be what it's indicating, what it's implied, that if Daniel and his three friends were reporting to the chief of the eunuchs, then they were of that group. So what happened to the royal males? Well, it didn't end there. Zedekiah was appointed to be the king after the deportation, but Zedekiah rebelled. So, I'm getting ahead of myself. In 597, the Babylonians invaded Judah, took Jeconiah and some of the noble men to Babylon, installed Zedekiah as the king in Judah. He was the brother of Jeconiah. But Zedekiah rebelled. And so the Babylonians, what a pain in the neck. You have to go get your army all over again, head back to Judah, take the country again, besiege the city, and this time Nebuchadnezzar was not a happy camper. Oops, I forgot to fill in the number, so it's X years. So he had to go again, besiege the city for, I can't remember what that was. Was it 2 years or so? Anyways, it was a real not happy thing. So this time the king took steps to make sure this will never happen again. And it states in Jeremiah that the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes at Riblah. And not just that, the king of Babylon also slew all the nobles of Judah, wiped right out. The only probable survivors would be the ones who had been taken to Babylon in the first deportation. Daniel, were now eunuchs, because they were no longer a threat to establish a kingdom. But all the other ones, he says, forget this. We're just wiping out all royal claims to the throne here. And that fulfilled the prophecy made to Coniah that no descendant of his would prosper on the throne of Israel. And it also starts something else. It appears that all royal males were slaughtered or castrated so they couldn't produce any more royal offspring. So the curse against Jeconiah was fulfilled. And he was the last of the line of kings from King Solomon. The line of King Solomon ends at that point. Now back to the genealogies. We see there that they converge immediately after Jeconiah. We see that a descendant of Nathan. Now keep in mind, this is hundreds of years after the time of Nathan and Solomon. So when the king of Babylon wiped out all the nobility, he would have only focused on the Solomon's line. He wouldn't have said, they wouldn't have traced all the other ancestors of David and wiped those out. Because those wouldn't be on the radar for nobility. It would be all the descendants of King Solomon just wiped out or made into eunuchs. So that presents a problem. Here's the possible explanation. That Jeconiah, and probably not Jeconiah, he's rotting away in jail, and he'll be rotting away for 37 years there. But the elders of Israel would have seen what happened to the sons of Jeconiah. In fact, to the whole Solomon, the whole line, the whole royal line has been wiped out or castrated. They would have seen that. But they also, remember, the genealogies had been preserved. And we know they've been preserved because when they return, they're consulting these genealogies. And they would know there's other descendants of King David here of the house of Nathan. And at that point, Shealtiel would be the firstborn of that generation. So he would have been adopted into the royal line, or assumed there was no throne anymore to occupy, but they would want to make sure that there was a royal line still preserved through Nathan rather than through Solomon. So Zerubbabel had two sons with the royal line going through Abihud and Mary descending from Risa. So for some helpful background information, we have a list of all David's sons there. Amnon was the firstborn. He should have had the throne of Israel, but he raped his half-sister, sorry to say, who was the full sister of Absalom, so Absalom killed him, end of that guy. Chileab, who also had another name, is never mentioned as being around an heir to the throne. He may have died young, either killed or died of some disease. Absalom was next in line, but he was killed by Joab. So after him, Adonijah was next in line for the throne of Israel, but when that throne was given to Solomon instead by a promise from David, rather than to the normal rightful heir. And when Adonijah made a bad move, wanting to, as a wife, Abishag, one of the concubines of David, that was seen as a challenge, and he was killed as well. The next four, I don't know what happened. They just simply not, they may have died, their lines may have ended, and then Nathan comes along, from whom Mary descends. And so we can infer from this that if they're going through who's the rightful heir here, they're going through the list, and they see, look, by now the lines have ended for all of these people, and Nathan is the oldest, if you go back to the time of David, would be the oldest surviving line that's there. So God ultimately chose Nathan to represent the house of David. Now there's possible additional support for this from Zechariah. Zechariah was written after this decision would have been made. It was at the time that Israel was returning from Babylon. Jeconiah was long since dead, and his sons had long been slaughtered, or all the nobility, and the house of Nathan was now. And what do we see? We see a prophecy pertaining to the return of the Messiah at the end of history. And it says, I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced. You could have a whole talk on this one. They will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one who mourns for an only son. And they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. Because at that time they will realize for thousands of years we have neglected and rejected our Messiah. For thousands, what have we done? I can't even imagine. But we're told here there will be weeping. And then it says, the land will mourn every family by itself. The family of the house of David, which would have preeminence if you're going to go through a list. And then the very next one here is the family of the house of Nathan by itself. So we see by that time, the house of Nathan was the highest ranking family in the house of David, which would be explained by what we've covered here. And then the house of Levi and so forth. So the conclusion here is that Matthew's genealogy represents the royal line of kings who are the heir of the throne of Israel. And Luke's genealogy is really Mary's genealogy and shows that Mary and Jesus were physical descendants of King David through Nathan, and thus fulfilling both promises that the Messiah would be rightful heir to the throne of Israel, so he had to be a descendant of through Abihud, the Matthew genealogy, and the Messiah would be a physical descendant of King David, which could only be fulfilled through Mary. Okay, take home. What can we take home from all this? Two thoughts. What might appear to be a contradiction at first, and many people point at Matthew and look, contradiction, Bible's pile of baloney, let's move on to something else. What might appear to be a contradiction at first glance can actually turn out to be a treasure trove of detailed information and understanding upon closer investigation. How God has sovereignly worked through history, bringing the threads together. And secondly, the two genealogies reveal that God has been involved in history, bringing about his plan. There may be changes, because he had originally told Saul that had he not messed up, his kingdom would never have ended. But Saul did mess up, and he was told by the prophet, for this reason it's taken from you and given to another. And so we see a shift in plans because of the sin of one man, but the overall plan is still in operation. And it will be carried out despite what we may see around us. Even today, When you look around at our civilization today, and I just had an email from a guy who's very, very disillusioned. Wickedness seems to be winning everywhere, he says, and I'd have to say, you know, it looks that way. It does. But this doesn't take God by surprise. He's been working for thousands of years. He's not going to drop the ball here in the last little section. He's been, even in the details, he has been working. Individual lives where and are involved, including you as an individual, his plan will be fulfilled. We can be confident that regardless of the evil we see around us, his will be done. He has a plan, and his kingdom will come. He's demonstrated that for the first arrival of the Messiah, and given all of that, that was fulfilled against, with interesting detail, we can be assured that the second part of his plan is on its way, and it will be fulfilled. Now, for all of you who would want to, the notes, there it is. You can just download that and later on, but let's close in prayer. Father, I thank you for these little insights you've given us into how your hand has worked throughout history, and insights you've given us to the personal thoughts of Mary, and that she actually is a physical descendant of King David, and that ancient prophecy or those series of prophecies were actually fulfilled. And not only that she is a physical descendant of King David, but it, as it turned out, the oldest prophecy all, that the Messiah would be of the seed of the woman, was fulfilled as well. In every detail, and Lord, I thank you that you have done all of this in the past, and now we look to the future. We are banking on this, Lord, and we have a confidence based on your word, what you have done, that this will be fulfilled, your kingdom will come, and your kingdom is here already in the lives of the believers. And the second part of that prayer, your will someday be done on earth as it is in heaven, and everything, you will put an end to lawlessness, establish righteousness. And Lord, when we look around the world today, we ask for the return of the King. We ask for the return of the King, the end of all human rule, Lord, the establishment of righteousness, putting an end to all lawlessness. And I thank you for the encouragement you've given us through your word this morning, that it will occur. It's already coming. It's on its way. The fulfillment of your prophecies, and our King is returning. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.